be seated. For most of the last decade now, I think, there's been a movement within the church that has started happening. It's often called the New Monastic Movement. And we have two parts of it here in our diocese. There's Ascension House, which is down by Christ Church, and I'm going to forget the name of the one that's down by St. George's, down by the university. But there are two communities where people are invited to live there for about 9 months out of the year in an intentional Christian community. Some of the people who are behind that are Shane Claiborne and a group that lives in Pennsylvania. And out of their community, they've put together a common prayer. It's a prayer book. It's called The Liturgy for Ordinary Radicals. Ordinary Radicals was one of Shane's first books. And in that, they talk about how they define this movement, which is not universal, but I really like one of their, they call them marks of new monasticism. So I thought I'd read you a little bit of how they describe this. Everything in our society teaches us to move away from suffering, to move out of neighborhoods where there is high crime, to move away from people who don't look like us. But the gospel calls us to something altogether different. We are to laugh at fear, to lean into suffering, to open ourselves to the stranger. Movements throughout church history have gone into the desert, to the slums, to the most difficult places on earth to follow Jesus. For some of us, that means remaining in difficult neighborhoods that we were born into, even though folks may think we are crazy for not moving out. For others, it means returning to a difficult neighborhood after heading off to college or job training to acquire skills. Choosing to bring those skills back to where we came from to help restore the broken streets. And for others, it may mean relocating our lives from places of so-called privilege to an abandoned place to offer our gifts for God's kingdom. Wherever we come from, Jesus teaches us that good can happen where we are, even if real estate agents and politicians aren't interested in our neighborhoods. Jesus comes from Nazareth, a town from which folks said nothing good could come. He knew suffering from the moment he entered the world as a baby refugee born in the middle of a genocide. Jesus knew poverty and pain until he was tortured and executed on a Roman cross. This is the Jesus we are called to follow. With his coming, we learn that the most dangerous place for Christians to be is in comfort and safety, detached from the suffering of others. Places that are physically safe can be spiritually deadly. The community Shane Claiborne lives in is in one of the abandoned communities in Pennsylvania. It's in a community that when they moved in was full of poverty. It was a food desert, which meant there was no easy access to a grocery store. And because it was the States, there were quite a lot of guns and other forms of violence. But a lot of those factors aren't specific to the community where they live. Here in Edmonton, we have places that are food deserts where there's no easy access to food. We have places of violence. We have places of desperation. I've been thinking about this mark of mission of their mission for a while and wondering what that means for a church like us. I don't have that answer yet, but I thought I would invite you to wonder about that with me for a while. Want to revisit social studies for a minute. How many people liked social studies class? Oh, good, a few. So there's some chance. Choir. Choir were social studies people, it looks like. Most of them. So if I say, I'm going to give you a phrase, the divine right of kings. Does that mean anything to anyone? Some nodding, some hand vague. Rob, you're the only person brave enough to like raise your hand at this point in time. So how would you define that?
Well, it was a perception of a population that their king had a right of authority over every aspect of society given to him from God.
Exactly. So to paraphrase your paraphrase, it's a societal assumption that existed for basically the Middle Ages, that kings had been given divine power and appointment to their position and their authority. Is that a fair? Yeah, Rob's nodding. We're in rough agreement here. I think we often look at this, and it's a social studies term for us. It's something that used to be. But when we read, especially this Old Testament story, I think if we have that in mind, we begin to understand the story a little bit differently. So there's one more step we need to make. Before we had the divine right of kings, before the Middle Ages, going back to, well, about the time of Naaman and Elijah, kings weren't sort of divinely appointed. There was often a mythology in the culture that the king was the god's son. So there was this king power divine relationship that was really tangled up together in a way we don't quite understand today. So Naaman is the commander of the army of the Arameans, and he has been afflicted with leprosy. And leprosy back then was sort of any skin condition. So maybe he was allergic to something and he had a rash, maybe he had eczema or psoriasis, or maybe he actually had the condition that we now understand is scientifically leprosy. But something was going on and it was a problem for him. Because in that world, which is not like and not entirely unlike our world, that sort of thing marked you as different and made you dangerous and put you at risk of being set aside from your society. But Naaman's wife had a slave. Some point in time, there was some raiding party, and they captured this Israelite girl who looked at her mistress's husband and said, "I know a guy. He's in Samaria," which was part of Israel at that point in time, "and he could help you, a prophet of the glory of the God." So Naaman, in true fashion of that time, thought, "You're talking about the king, this, you know, divine ruler figure. So I'll go to my king and I'll get a letter of introduction and we'll go on a trip and it will all be fine." So Naaman, with all of his fancy presents and his nice letter, shows up at the king of Israel's doorstep, and the king says, "They're trying to start a war. Because they have brought me a request, and they've done it, you know, with the nice letter, with all of the presents, and I can't do this thing. So I'm going to have to send him away, and then they're going to be angry because I didn't do the very nice request that they asked me for." And the king was very worried, because Israel doesn't really win a lot of wars in this time. The Arameans are a much bigger force. And then Elijah says, wait, stop worrying, send them to me." So Naaman goes to see Elijah, where he doesn't get the royal treatment. This is no, you know, the prophet of God runs no spa here. Elijah sends a messenger out and says, "Go bathe in the Jordan River 7 times. 7 times, just like 7 days of creation, 7 times, and you will be made clean." And Naaman, who must have been feeling a little bit like he was getting the runaround, I mean, he started out with the king, and now he's in front of some building, and a messenger has just told him what to do and dismissed him, says, "I have better rivers. which is probably true. The Jordan, we think of the Jordan, I think, more like the North Saskatchewan, big and wide and deep. And this is the Middle East, and that is not how rivers work there. It's narrow, not that deep, and more like a creek, from what I understand, than what we think of as a river. So Naaman hears this, and he thinks of the parts of the world he is from where they have something closer to rivers and not like the Jordan, and his pride gets hurt. And then his servants, who probably, it seems like from this, care about Naaman, but probably also don't want his entire household to be cast out of society, say, why not try it? Why not? So Naaman does, and he is healed. And if you were paying attention, you'll notice that the slave girl, the one who set this all about, gets one line and then she disappears. She gets one line, one part. It's an important but sort of a bit part in this. She's not Elijah. She's not Naaman. She's not a king. She's a slave who says something important, and then history keeps moving on past her. But I think she remembers something that we often forget. In our gospel today, Jesus gathers 70 of his disciples. In the Gospel of Luke, there's two sending out of disciples. So he's already sent out sort of the disciples whose names we have, that sort of top 12, and that's gone well. So he's gathered up more of them, and he's about to send them off, convincing them, really, that apart from him, God is active in their lives. That this thing Jesus is doing is about Jesus, but happens apart from him, that continues to exist when Jesus is out of sight and out of place to act as a resource. And Jesus is right. That may not seem, we've heard this story a lot now, that may not seem like a shock to us. But these disciples are more like Naaman than anyone else in a lot of ways. They're pretty sure that God acts through specific people in the right country at the right time if you bring the right gifts. Which, on bad days, is more like me than I want to admit. But Jesus sends them out, asks them to think a little bit more like the slave girl than anyone else in this story, asks them to imagine a world where God cares about people who aren't like them, who aren't sons of Abraham and inheritors of the promise from birth. Asks them to wonder what it might look like if the promise of God is bigger than we are. So that's the other thing I didn't tell you when I was retelling Naaman's story. Gods in those days were seen as territorial. And the God of Israel really only had cause to be concerned about the lands of Israel and the people who were born there. Naaman had little right to come and ask for help. But desperation makes us do crazy things, doesn't it? Imagine the kinds of things it makes a God who is desperate to love the world God created to do. Crazy enough, perhaps, to be born and live as one of the people God created. Crazy enough to continue to entrust the mission of God a mission that is bigger than the people of God have ever dreamed yet, and to people who keep making mistakes. Crazy enough to send us out into a world that doesn't always know what to do, that operates on different rules, with different understandings of who is powerful and who is important and who should be listened to. Crazy enough to believe that that could bring about the kingdom of God, one where there is no outside and where justice and peace reign. Amen.